The Fern Line is supported by the Alaska Rock Gym, providing quality indoor climbing to the Anchorage community since 1995. Alaska Rock Gym sports 20,000 square feet of climbing, an entire floor of boulder terrain, beautiful locker rooms, plus expanded cardio fitness and yoga rooms. Stop by anytime to take a tour of the facility or check out the Alaska Rock Gym online at alaskarockgym.com.
Hey, Evan, did you hear that?
Dude, it's a hoarding marmot. Looking for that last-minute piece of kit before heading into the hills? Make sure and stop by the Hoarding Marmot, Anchorage's finest outdoor consignment shop located in the heart of Spinard. The Hoarding Marmot has everything you need from high-end mountaineering gear, cross-country and downhill ski equipment, as well as a fine selection of local guidebooks, maps, and yummy trail snacks. Stop by the Hoarding Marmot next time you roll through town or check them out online at hoardingmarmot.com. All right, let's get to the show. Friends, I'm Evan Phillips, and you're listening to The Fern Line, a podcast about the lives of mountain climbers. On Season 3, I'm chatting with alpinists and other outdoor enthusiasts who are pushing the limits of creativity in the mountains and in their daily lives. My goal is to have meaningful conversations with extraordinary people, the folks who choose to live full-value lifestyles in some of the most beautiful and wild regions on the planet. All right. Well, it's great to be back with you for another episode of The Fern Line. I hope you're all doing great and enjoying the beautiful summer weather in Alaska and beyond. It's been an awesome summer so far. Hey, before we dive into today's episode, I just want to remind listeners that if you enjoy this podcast, there's a few ways you can really help out. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can tell someone directly. Word of mouth is the best way to get information out there, and it really helps create the grassroots vibe I'm going for. Tell your friends, your climbing partners, people you think might dig the Fern Line, let them know it's out there. And if you want to go the extra mile to helping keep this show up and running, you can become a monthly subscriber on Patreon. Just head on over to patreon.com/thefernline, and you can sign up there. All right, well, the time has come to grab your favorite beverage and get cozy on your couch, camp chair, or your 400-square-foot snow cave on the southeast fork of the Kahilna, and settle in for this episode of The Fern Line.
It was the strongest climber I've ever climbed, you know, by far. And so solid. You know, he's the sort of person that if you were inclined to go out on a limb, he'd be the person I'd want to go with.
On today's episode of The Fern Line, we'll get to know alpinist and author Simon McCartney. Back in the late 1970s, the norms of mountaineering were changing, moving away from the heavy siege-style tactics of the past to the light and fast alpine style of the future. Although forward-thinking alpinists had been employing these tactics in the mountains for years, only a small, committed group of climbers were pushing the standards in Alaska. Two of those climbers were Simon McCartney and Jack Roberts. Beginning in 1978, the confident and brash duo made the first and only ascent of the exceedingly dangerous north face of Mount Huntington. Then, in 1980, the team upped the ante when they climbed the enormous 8,000-foot southwest face on Denali. Although the pair readily handled the technical difficulties on the face, it was the insidious onset of cerebral edema that nearly killed Simon high on the peak. The ensuing, harrowing descent down the Cassine Ridge affected Simon deeply, so much so that he never climbed again. But the friendship Simon formed with his partner, Jack Roberts, never left him. And after almost 35 years, in a full circle chain of events, Simon would write a book about the two life-changing climbs he'd shared with Jack. The book, titled The Bond, was published in 2017 and was an instant mountaineering classic, winning the esteemed Boardman Tasker Award. A few months ago, I was fortunate to have a long conversation with Simon. We talked at length about the climbs up Huntington and Denali, the importance of his relationship with Jack, and what it meant for him to write The Bond. Simon started the conversation by describing his fateful meeting with Jack in the Alps in the summer of 1977.
Well, I met him in the Bar National. Where else? There was no internet in the 70s, but you could meet people in countries all around the world by climbing pubs, and the Bar National was the best of all. I was there, not alone, because you can never be alone there, but I was killing time, and into the bar walked a group of Americans, which is unusual in Chamonix. I mean, Americans have many lovely things to climb at home, so you don't often see large groups of them in Europe, at least I hadn't anyway, but Jack Roberts was one of that group. So was Rick Akamoza. So was Steve Shea, Mug Stump, and Tobin Sorensen. So these were well-known guys. And I got talking to Jack, you know, who was very, he reminded me of Clint Eastwood with long hair or something. You know, he was very laconic, irreverent sense of humor. And we hit it off straight away. We got chatting, and I said, look, Jack, you know, just, not much we can do in Chamonix. The weather's terrible and the snow's everywhere. And so, why don't you come back to the UK and I'll take you rock climbing in the West Country, something different. He'd been to the UK earlier that year. So, well, I'll take you to Cheddar Gorge. You know, it's a 400-foot limestone cliff, and you know, I think you'll love it. So that's what we did. And we hitchhiked to Paris and got a lift back to London, stayed with my parents for 24 hours, and then, you know, straight off to the crags. It became apparent that we thought the same things were funny, and we climbed very well together. It was the first time, really, that I'd been climbing with someone who was of a very similar capability to me. I mean, he was better at some rock climbing things than I was, but I was better at some other things than he was, but very, very even, and it was an unusual experience. And we had such a good time that in a pub somewhere in the West Country, we decided that we were going to go to Alaska next year. Jack persuaded me that there were many, many things, you know, that needed to be climbed in Alaska because it hadn't been developed like the European Alps. We didn't know what we were going to climb, just that it would probably be the Roof Gorge somewhere, but it would be a good place to start. And then I saw a copy of Mountain Magazine that had a photograph by Brad Washburn on the front cover. And it was an aerial photograph of the north face of Mount Huntington. I looked under the comment and it said that the unclimbed north face of Mount Huntington. And there was a comment there from Brad advising future climbers not to go near it because it was just too dangerous. You know, that was like a red flag to a bull. You know, it's unclimbed, it's so beautiful, and it's dangerous. You know, that's my Eiger. You know, I'd always wish that I'd been born earlier so I could have made the first ascent to the north face of the Eiger, but not an ascent. So with no research, I hadn't read any books. I hadn't read Thérèse's book. I hadn't read Dave Roberts's book. I have now. And, you know, I'd looked at a map. I didn't know what the Harvard route was. We just went and did it. Not immediately. As you can see in the Bond, you know, we were hanging around that valley for a long time.
Right.
In very bad weather. We dug a huge snow hole to live in and then expanded it into two separate bedrooms. So we didn't have to bother each other. A lounge area where we could entertain. You know, people like Charlie Porter were camping near us. Charlie was huge fun. Done so many things in there. He was so quiet about it. You know, it was Jack that had to whisper in my ear that Charlie had soloed the Casino Ridge the year before. The weather had been dreadful, but then it came very good, very suddenly, and thought, well, it's now or never. And we went for it. Yeah. We were aware of the risks, but I think at 22, I thought I was immortal. The start of the climb is quite technical, you know, sort of 5.8, 5.9 in crampons. There's like a rock band that's completely overhung by seracs, quite unstable seracs. But on the left-hand end of that band, the seracs get smaller, and we could get up there. We could get around the end of them into the central ice field on the face, and then we should be able to climb more or less directly to the summit. But we hadn't really understood what happens in Alaska when it snows on Huntington. The angle of the face is just exactly wrong. It'll hold snow just for a little while and then start to avalanche, or, you know, within an hour. And the weather went bad. We got around the end of the seracs. We thought, my goodness, you know, we're really going to do this. And we failed to notice that the weather was becoming dreary and then started to snow. And then, you know, within an hour, we were in a washing machine, snow slides, you know, running like bow waves over my boots and ice tools. Jack was collecting you know, avalanches in the face, and I think that he thought that we were goners. But I found a crevasse. Of course, there was a crevasse. You know, there's a hanging ice field in the middle, and I got to the top of it and found this, you know, very very accommodating crevasse, big enough for us to lie down and spread ourselves out. You know, I never saw him never look more harrowed than when we got to that place. And as he climbed in and looked around, you know, rolling his eyes, thinking, oh my God, there's avalanches now pounding past our window.
Right.
I thought, I'd try and lighten it up. You know? And Jack and I, for some reason, quite like the Wizard of Oz. And why, I don't know. But it, you know, I said to him, I said, Toto, I don't think we're in Canvas anymore. We spent the night there. We discussed it a little bit. We realized that getting down was not an option anymore. I mean, I don't say that it's impossible, but surviving it would be very unlikely. So the only way out was up. But we thought that what was in front of us would be easier than what was behind. So as soon as it stopped snowing, we got on with it. And we didn't get far. I mean, we couldn't hang around because we had only taken 4 days' food. The next day, we didn't get far at all. We climbed diagonally into the middle of the face. We were trying to avoid this rock buttress. And then it started to snow worse than the day before. And avalanche properly. I remember hearing something like concrete being poured from a very great height. And I managed to save myself by getting under a little rock overhang where I was setting up an anchor.
Wow.
But Jack collected it full in the face. It knocked him unconscious and it knocked him off his feet. And I had his full weight on the rope. But I could feel the lumps of snow pounding into him because I could feel them through the rope. And, you know, I'm shouting and shouting, are you okay? And eventually he came to, shook himself like a dog. And luckily he didn't drop any of the equipment and let out some of the worst language that I've ever heard in my life. And, you know, he climbed up to me, you know, angry, you know. You know, now we've got to save ourselves, you know, we're trapped. But we were lucky. We managed to find that we could dig underneath this piece of rock a little bit. We couldn't get in very far, but we could get in about a meter, and then we could turn 90 degrees so we could make a snow hole entrance and then turn right and create a great big long thin snow hole. And that's what we did. So we, you know, I eventually crawled in there feet first, and then he crawled in after me head first. So we were head to head with the stove in between, and we tried to make jokes and make tea, you know, through the night. While this awful storm you know, blew itself out. So now it's, you know, very obvious that we're in quite a serious position. But, you know, Jack and I never used to talk about things like that. It was just unhelpful. It took us 2 days to get to the summit from there, which was very slow because the climbing was much harder than we thought it would be. We only had that one picture, so we couldn't really see the angle of what was coming. And there's a feature we called the ramp. I like to call things after Iger names, so I chose the ramp. And we found that we could avoid the ramps, like a hanging glacier with seracs in it. but we found we couldn't avoid all of them. And so some very technical ice climbing. I mean, nowadays, I think, you know, the climbing would be much easier with the tools that people have, you know, lightweight boots, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, all in all, we had quite good equipment. We were using Curvers, which was the latest ice axe at the time. But the climbing was hard, and it was made worse by the fact we only had 5 ice screws or something.
Yeah. They probably weren't very sharp compared to the ones you have today.
No. You had to hit them with a hammer and then wind them in with your pick.
Right.
I didn't look at climbing for 35 years when I quit in 1980, and I came back to it and was looking at this guy putting an ice screw in on a YouTube video or something, just winding it in with his hand. Gee, if placement's that bad, why even bother? You know, you're just wasting time doing that. But of course, they work really well. So it was a fight, and we bivouacked 2 more times. We had some friends on the West Fork of the Roof, a team led by Rob Newsom, and they'd been attempting to make an ascent of the French Ridge, the Terre Northwest Ridge, and they'd failed. And we saw them, the dots on the glacier below us, and we were able to holler at each other. And we could hear them whooping at us. They'd realized that we were likely to make it to the center of the North Face because we were nearly there. But it crossed our minds at the moment, you know, how come they're there? They were really, really quick, or they failed. And this was a concern because we'd intended, don't laugh, but Jack and I had intended to climb down the French Ridge. That was our plan. It's the most ridiculous, stupid thing you could ever think of doing. The French Ridge is an absolute nightmare of overhanging cornices and all that good stuff you get at Alaska. Anyway, we got to the summit, and the only footprints were ours. It hadn't snowed really for a few days, so it wasn't as though someone had been there and they'd been drifted over or anything. You know, no one had been to the summit that year. We thought, okay. I was hoping to find a trail, you know, but we didn't. When you leave the summit at Mount Huntingdon, there's like a sort of a flat shoulder, and then it drops over an overhanging cornice. And we realized that, you know, getting down was going to be incredibly difficult. So I started to look at, you know, the edge of the ridge to see if I could see a way that we could get around this thing. And I fell through the cornice back onto the North Face. Jack held me well enough, but I twisted my ankle quite badly. You know, I'd spent a horrendous 10 minutes, you know, waiting for the pain to subside and then climbing back up to join him, trying to hide the limp, you know. So, man, you know, we're not going down that way. So Jack thought he knew where the Harvard route might be, and we started down this snow slope, down climbing, and we were lucky. I found a piece of tape. Okay, you know, someone's been here before. And then I found another one. So we could start to rappel, and I could find fixed rope everywhere. It was sort of, someone had sieged it. And we thought, this is going to be great. You know, we'll be down today. You know, maybe we do 30 abseils or something, and we're off it. And there's a thing called the nose pitch, which I know now, then I didn't. And it's a big overhang with an aid crack underneath it.
Yeah.
And we rappelled right over the edge of it, very carefully, making sure that the ropes were twisted, all that good stuff you do when you're setting up a rappel. And I got down to a, you know, very comfortable snow slope below. Come on, Jack, come on down. He did. And then we pulled the ropes, and we got about 80 foot of it, and it jammed.
Oh, man.
And like nothing we could do. You know, we tried flicking it. We couldn't climb back up. Didn't have any GMRs or anything like that. And anyway, how could you climb up one rope you don't know what it's attached to? It was horrendous. We were in such a serious situation. We were like 10 pitches down from the top of the Harvard route with no rope, or with very little rope. We managed to cut off about 60 feet of it. That's all we had. So rappelling was, you know, hardly. We had to downtime. And me with my bad ankle, Jack was kind of looking out for me a bit because he was in better shape. And over 54 hours, we picked our way down that route. And as we could, we would cut bits of fixed rope out of the ice and knot them together like a big, ugly washing line. So at some stage, we got 60 feet of retrievable rope. You know, one side was the bit of rope we cut off, and the other side was all these horrible knotted things. So when you were descending on it, you couldn't use a descender. You had to use a very traditional, you know, abseil with it wrapped around your body so the knots wouldn't jam. That was hell. But we didn't stop. You know, we got down to the Stegosaurus Ridge, and a few hours later, we stepped over the Bergschrund at the bottom of the west face onto the Tokositna Glacier on a beautiful sunny day. And we realized that, you know, we were probably going to get away with it. We ran out of food long ago, but we had some white gas to make tea, or at least hot water, so we weren't dehydrated. Jack confessed to me at that point that he had some problems with his toes. It turned out he crossed. I said, well, how long have you had that? Why didn't you mention it? He said, well, I've got it on the summit, but what was the point of raising it then? You know, so we tried to warm his feet up and put him into his sleeping bag, and I did the same, passed out. Slept all day in the sun, and Jack woke me up in the end. You're okay. You didn't so much fall asleep as go unconscious. I even checked your pulse. You know, but we were very close by that time, Jack and I. And that night, we decided to wait till it got cold, and then we walked across the Tokositna Glacier, kick steps across it. It was deep, crusty snow. And then climb up the side of the northwest ridge that separated us from where we wanted to be, which was the west fork of the roof where our camp was. We got up there when that half-hour sunset thing that Alaska does, you know, where the mountain, the sun just goes behind Denali for a minute and then pops up around the other side. And I think it's amazing. Anyway, we get back onto the roof, and you know that snow cave was the most windswept place on earth, probably, but it was heaven to us. We got a brew on, we got some food happening. I warmed up. We had a radio there that Jim Sharp, our pilot, gave us, and we warmed up the batteries and managed to get Doug Geating, one of the other glacier pilots, on the line, and said, "Oh yeah, you know, Sharp's been looking for you guys for days. You know, glad to hear you. But, you want to get out?" I said, "Yeah, we need to get out." "All right, I'll tell Sharp." And then 5 minutes later, he said, "Yeah, I got him line of sight. He knows where you are. It says he'll be here in an hour. Please be ready to leave immediately." And he was gone. And I thought, my God, you know, after living in here for nearly a month, you know, I was with Jack and almost hardly anybody else most of the time. And we were going to leave in an hour and it would all be over. So suddenly, it was shocking. And Jack did this really good sketch of the route. He's very good at drawing. You know, we stared up at it and took a few more pictures. And we heard the little bird coming. And I could see it. You know, there it is, this Jim. His little Cessna 185 was painted white and orange, clattered to a halt in front of us, and revved the engine to full power and spun it around so that he was facing the way that he'd come in his own ski track. Very skillful. We threw everything in, and we were gone. It was too noisy to talk or express anything. You know, I didn't know how I felt until just before I got to Tarkita, I discovered that the emotion that I had was pride that we'd done it. Being back in Tarkita was strange. You know, you've gone from living on the moon for a long time, having only one person for company, and we didn't talk much anyway. So we're back somewhere green and nice. You know, the first thing in my head is any other British climbers that need a beer. Jack said, no, you need a shower. Just that no one is standing anywhere near you. I suspect I stink as well, but we just don't notice anymore. And Jim's saying, yeah, that's why I flew back with the windows open on the Cessna. And I wondered about that. You know, why did you fly a plane with the windows open? Anyway, we had a shower at Jim's place. Wandered in town, you know, limping like a couple of derelicts, me with my ankle and hit Jack with his sore toes. And we were pretty down the first night. I mean, we had one or two beers. We went straight to our head. We got to bed, exhausted. Stupidly, we'd left the tent open, and it was full of mosquitoes. You know, those awful skeets you get in Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
They're just horrible beasts. So we had a miserable day.
Yeah.
The next day, we perked up. And you know, we were full of fun. And we met some people. I met a guy called Fred Finney, who I've since connected with. Fred's very kind and sent me some pictures of our meeting in Tarkita in 1978. Jack must have sold him an ice axe, because when Fred contacted me after reading the book, he said, "Look, I've got one of your ice axes." "Really?" He said, "Yeah, I think it's Jack's, because he had two. We had to spare everything, so Jack would have sold it to make some beer money." So we're on the way to Yosemite. But Fred donated it to Neptune's climbing store in Boulder, Colorado. And it's hanging on the wall in Gary Neptune's climbing museum.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And Yeah, so that was my first trip to Alaska.
The Huntington climb solidified Simon and Jack's partnership and would set the tone for their future objectives. In the ensuing season, 1979, the climbers continued honing their mountain craft, albeit with different partners. Simon even made a coveted winter ascent on the north face of the Eiger. But it was the call of the Alaska Range that would bring the two friends back to Talkeetna in the summer of 1980. This time, they would attempt the unclimbed 8,000-foot southwest face of Denali, a climb that would create a life-changing sequence of events that Simon would write about in his book, The Bond, more than 30 years later. Sunshine and the rain. I long to see when the city's got me drained. Old dirt road, my dear friend, my dear friend.
So I was working at Alpine Sports, which is a climbing store in London. I got a phone call from America, which is really unusual. I thought it could only be Jack. It was. He says, you know, my spies have been keeping tabs on you. You've been having fun on the Eiger. I said, oh, you heard about that, did you? He said, well, what are you doing this summer? We're talking about the summer of 1980. I said, I don't really have any plans. When you go to the mine, he said, well, remember we were looking at a picture of the southwest face of Denali when we were in the ranger station in Talkeetna in 1978. Yeah, I remember. It's still unclimbed. He said, yep. Yeah. No one's touched it. So this is this huge expanse to the left, as you look at it, to the left of the Cassim Ridge. In fairly quick time, we decided that we were going to make the first ascent of the southwest face of Denali and do it in Alpine style. We called ourselves the Too Loose Climbing Expedition. Yeah, there's this funny thing in Alaska where all the climbing expeditions have to have names. And you don't get that anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's just Roberts and McCartney, you know, but then it's got to be the name. So we borrowed a name from Rob Newson called Too Loose because that seemed to us that's how we were. We were under-equipped and over-relaxed, probably, but in very good shape. The southeast fork of the Kehelton is not such a great place, I found. I was used to the roof and being completely alone. But to be in a bit of a climbing zoo with the Boyne or Mild in the normal way up the West Buttress with so many people is odd. But the weather was very good and we set about it. Took a couple of goes to pull our gear up to just below the ice fall on the Kehelton and northeast fork, the Valley of Death, it was called, for good reasons. While we were up there one day, we ran into Mike Helms and Bob Candicum, who were two guys going to climb the Cassim Ridge. And that would have been significant. It would have been probably the fourth alpine ascent ever of the Cassim Ridge. They didn't know each other. They'd both been on another expedition where their friends had had to leave and just left those two wanting to continue. And Bob was able to borrow some double boots that fitted him. So they decided to climb the Cassim. And it turned out to be fateful later. But they were great guys, good talkers, you know, and good fun to be with. We got close to them quite quick because we all nearly got killed in an avalanche on the first camp. Bob was outside with Mike and I heard the crack and the noise and I could see Bob turn around and the blood drain from his head and start running. You know, he wasn't dressed, running barefoot in the snow as fast as he can away from the tent. And I just zipped it up. And when it all stopped, there were blocks of ice the size of Volkswagens leaning on our tent. You know, we were just exactly where it stopped. So we got quite close with Bob and Mike. And the next day, we moved up to about 11. It was very windy and extremely cold. But Mike had been carrying a carpenter's saw with him. And I was reluctant to ask him why he was carrying a carpenter's saw. I had a shovel and I understood that was important. Why would you carry that kind of saw? And he was using it as a sort of super snow saw. and he was dynamite at making igloos. So we made a practice igloo for one of them, and then another one for Bob, and then Jack and I made a huge igloo that was so big that we could pitch the tent inside it. And so comfortable, you know, completely windless. And it was pleasant to be there, but not relaxing because we knew what we had in front of us. And I can't remember the date. It was a very clear night, no wind. And we set out at first light, 6 o'clock in the morning, and started toward the face and started climbing. The first, 1,800 feet's not too bad. You know, there's some snowy tongues that you can follow that get you some height fairly easily. And then we found them, we just mixed climbing. It was really very little ice, but lots of rock covered with snow. And, you know, that rock band at the bottom of the Southwest Face is about 4,000 feet high, something like that. Maybe a little more, a little less, but it's bigger than El Capitan.
Wow.
No, it's not quite as steep as El Capitan where we are, but some parts of it are.
Right.
The scale of it is just enormous. And that only gets you halfway up the Southwest Face. After that, the mountain relents, and there's a snowfield and then some gullies that lead to the casino, literally to the summit. We didn't know much about acclimatization or anything. We figured that we'd spent enough time on the approach, and because the climbing was technical, we wouldn't be going that fast, so we should be able to acclimatize on the route because we know much better now. Second day, we had a major setback. We started to get into some climbing that was much more difficult than we had anticipated. I got a 5'9" chimney, you know, with ice in the back of it, nearly fell out of it, which would have killed us both. Just managed to get through that. Jack then has problems with his feet. He had frostbite, he told me, the winter before. He climbed on Mount Robson, Hogan. And got frostbitten. I said, Matt, you know, I really wished you would have told me that before we started up this thing.
Right.
And now he's got blisters on his heels. He's bleeding into his boots because he's using some newfangled crampon that doesn't hold his foot down as well as it should. And then I'll go up and move again. So on day three, I think, we find this huge boulder in the middle of the face. The middle of the Southwest Face has the singular largest piece of rock I've ever seen. You know, it's about 500 foot high and maybe 300 foot wide. It's just a big rock. And it's slightly overhanging. So underneath it, there's a big snow ledge. And that became the best bivouac site I've ever experienced. We could pitch the tent, you know, on level ground.
Wow.
And it was perverse, you know. It felt so, it was a great bivouac site, totally safe from any kind of avalanche whatsoever. It's flat. It was like being on the moon. You know, the problem is you've got to get off it. You might be in Tranquility Base, but you've got a long way to go. And although we spent an extra night there, this Jack wasn't feeling too great. You know, we knew we had to move. And we also learned that we couldn't go the way that we thought we would because we were going to climb straight up this big dihedral. And when we got to the bottom of it, we realized that we didn't have enough gear. So we had a few friends, maybe half a dozen pins and some nuts. That's about it, maybe six icicles. So there was no way that we could aid that dihedron. It looked like we might have to because it had overhanging ice in it. So we found our own way, and we went left from the boulder and had to wander around, zigging and zagging for a couple of days. Jack found, I got underneath a cliff that I couldn't avoid that had an off-foot crack in it, and we looked to be blocked completely. So time to get serious. You know, Jack, the stone master, thinks that he can climb the off-foot crack because Jack can do everything. He's a really rounded climber, but it's not like an off-foot from Yosemite. We're at 16,000 feet now. That's cold. And he's going to have to strip off, you know, down to his thermal gear to be able to climb properly at that standard. Anyway, he decides to look to the right, and he found what we now call the Roberts Traverse, which is solid 5'9". It's the damnedest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's the most inspiring piece of climbing in double boots at high altitude. Luckily, the protection on it wasn't so bad. I had the most awful time following that pitch. It was a diagonal rising traverse, and I had to be hauled up it. And at the end of that, we were exhausted. You know, we managed to chop out a ledge. So we think, well, we must be close now. You know, we could see around us that we must be close to the point where the rocks give way. And the next day they did. I got the last pitch in the rocks, and I'm on the ice field that dominates the upper half of the southwest face of Denali. And okay, you know, now it's just step kicking. You know, we at lower altitude, we probably would have dispensed with the rope because the climbing is straightforward now. But I'd started to get sick, and I'd attributed it just to regular altitude sickness, but it was getting much worse. It was affecting my balance, which I've never felt before. You know, I had the agility of a cat at that age. And to have to lean on my ice axe for balance, there's something wrong. And I didn't know it, but I had the onset of cerebral edema, which is a really acute high altitude sickness, which is well understood now, but my brain is swelling and pressing on the cranium, and bit by bit, pressure is shutting me down. But we camped, and then the next day made some pathetic progress. You know, we only got to about 17,500 feet, had to camp again. I was just so bad. The next day, we only made it to about 18,000 feet. You know, very, very slow. We should have dispensed with all of that in a day. And the next day, we made it onto the Kasing Ridge, which cheered us up a bit. Suddenly, you can see the whole other half of Denali, because the casino has been blocking the view up until that point. You get some sense of where you are on top of America. And I sat down and took a picture and a rest, and then realized that I couldn't get up. Like my legs wouldn't work. I tried to stand up and fell down. And this is really alarming for Jack. You know, he thinks that maybe I'm giving up or something. He said, no, you know, I can't stand up. I can't. Like a crawl, literally crawl my hands and feet. And Jackson sort of takes charge of the situation. He says, we can't stay here, you can't go down, you're going to die if we sit here, I'll die if we sit here, I'm going to pull you up this thing. And that's what he tried to do. But we didn't get far, we got to about 19.4, 19.5, something like that, we're close. And I collapsed more or less completely. And we wound up spending 3 days there. Me deteriorating, his frostbite getting worse and worse. We haven't eaten by the end of that for like a couple of days, although we still have a little fuel left. So we're about, I don't know, 10 days into the climb. He tried to encourage me to crawl up the Kasing Ridge and couldn't do it. We had to go back and put the tent back up again. And then Jack's journals, he's tearing himself to pieces. He said, what do I do? Do I leave and go for the summit, try and get some help? Because he was still, apart from his feet, he's still quite fit. You know, I don't want to leave Simon. You know, it's the most awful dilemma that anybody could ever have. You know, your best buddy's lying in the tent, obviously going to die. And do you stay there? And what do you do? Anyway, lucky for Jack, the decision was taken out of his hands because he was preparing to leave, and I had agreed with it. Apparently, I remember writing something down, and it turned up in his journals. And wouldn't you know it, Bob Candico and Mike Helms turn up. All roads lead to the summit. And they've intersected with us because we're on the Kasing Ridge and so are they. It was just a matter of time. We thought they'd be so much quicker than us. It hadn't. They'd been just the same speed, more or less, a bit slower. And they're in much better shape. They have been eating. Bob and Mike and Jack have like a council of war to decide what to do. And they decide that Mike, who knows Denali well, he's climbed the West Buttress before, and Jack should go for help because he's got frostbite. And anyway, he can climb quite quickly. Obviously, I'm going nowhere, so that left to Bob to volunteer to stay with me and wait for a rescue. Now, that sounds like incredibly muddled thinking at sea level. I mean, who on earth is going to rescue you at 900 feet below the summit on the Kasing Ridge? I mean, most people who climb Denali can only just manage to get the summit back themselves, let alone climb down the wrong side. But they were convinced that was the only thing to do. And Bob and I were left alone Bob tried to do the same thing to Jack. He tried to drag me. Didn't work. Then we realized that we would die if we stayed there. So we started to descend the Kissing Ridge. He would lower me on a rope. I'd slide down on my butt until I got to the end of 150-foot rope, and then I'd stick my ice axe in the snow, and I'd wait for him to climb down and join me, and we'd do it again and again and again. Luckily, the first bit of the Cassine below us was snowy, and we were able to lose some height. My head started to clear, you know, just that extra little bit of oxygen. I must have been right on the edge with cerebral edema, and I started to be able to stand up. I could function, tie knots, I could contribute. And bit by bit, Bob and I picked our way down the Cassine Ridge. We camped at all of the campsites that he'd used, all five of them, on the way up and the way down. And we dug up rubbish that we knew could be around. We tried making tea out of toothpaste. I never do that. It's not good. The one thing that saved our lives is that we found a gallon of Blazo, white gas. And some rope. And it had been left there by four climbers who climbed the Cassine, the ridge the year before. One of those climbers has since contacted me. His name is Bob Dugan. And I've sent them all a copy of the book signed by me to thank them for the gasoline, because they had too much of everything and they left it there. And that enabled us to survive, because we would have been out. We actually went without eating for almost 10 days. But we were able to make water and to put enough pollutants into it, like old tea bags if we had them. And on the last day I was alone with Bob, we were rappelling through the second rock band, recycling pitons that we could find, because stupidly I'd thrown all my rock climbing gear away because I thought I would never need it again. We were improvising, you know, bits of old fixed rope and old pitons that we replaced. And I've got one more abseil to go to get off this thing. And I'm so tired now that I've tied a knot in the end of the rope, because I think I might be careless enough to abseil off the end of the rope. And Bob's shouting at me, pointing. And I'm looking up. I said, "What are you saying?" And he's looking there. I look down and there's an illusion. There's four guys standing next to a Willens box tent at the bottom of the cliff. You know, I really shake my head. It's a very convincing illusion. But it's true. They start to talk to me. They're real. And I get to the end of the rope and I nearly do abseil off the end of it. One of the guys grabs me and clips me and into an anchor and bundles me into their huge box tent. And starts to care for me in the way that sober people care for very drunk people. You know, I'm obviously not in good shape. I'm a bit bobbed out as well. It's an expedition called the Freaks, which was an acronym. It stood for Far Out Environmentally Aware Climbers or something. They're all from Pennsylvania. I've since become very good friends with one of them, Mike Pantley. And they were kind to us. I mean, they probably weren't in great shape on the Cassine. They were nearly out of food. It's not a good place to be on the ridge. But nonetheless, they were kind to us. And they did feed us, which was terrible because they only had Mexican food. When you haven't eaten for 10 days, a really spicy, dehydrated Mexican dinner isn't really the best thing you want to eat. But we realized that if they descended with us, we'd have a chance, which is what happened. And over the next 2 days, we managed to descend with them all the way back down to the saddle at 14.2, the Hanging Glacier. Bob unties himself from the rope, jumps over the Bergschrund, and then runs down the ice field. I've got no idea what he's doing. Maybe he's finally lost it. In the distance, he's seen three Japanese climbers that we've met previously. And he knows they've got a radio. And Bob's enduring fear had become not his own life or mine, but that his parents would learn that we were missing and presumed dead, which is exactly what happened. It's just that they hadn't informed his parents yet, but that was the consensus, that we were lost, because they hadn't seen us for a very long time. I forgot to mention that we got overflown by a plane at about 18,000 feet and they saw us descending, but then never again. And Bob comes back, he explains what he's done, and he said, "Look, They said, do you want to be rescued? And he looks at me. I said, what did you say? And I said, no. He said, well, that's what I would have wanted you to say. He said, yeah, I thought you'd say that. You know, having come this far, we will survive this, I think. And I'd like to get off the mountain on my own 2 feet. And he felt the same way. So we set up camp in the sun, and a helicopter, he'd arranged for a food drop. So the Parks were coming in anyway to pick up some frostbite victims from the West Buttress. And they passed over us and unloaded some duffel bags and cardboard boxes full of food. So we were okay. We could eat for the whole of the rest of the day and start to undo some of the damage. Then I decided to take my boots off for the first time in 2 weeks. I've got quite little feet, and in double boots, I don't see any need to take the inner boot off ever because it's so comfortable. But I should have, because when I took it off, my feet swelled up like watermelons, and the pain was absolutely excruciating. So I now had a new set of problems, is that walking was very difficult. So we still got to descend the arete, which is quite tricky. When we got to the top of the Japanese couloir, the Japanese had fixed it with a beautiful new 9mm rope from top to bottom. So Bob and I were able to descend a Japanese couloir in probably an hour, and then painfully limp back to the igloos that we'd built almost exactly a month before. I worked out when I was writing the book that I was on Denali for 29 days from the beginning to the end, with 10 days food. The next day we... skiing, we've got our skis back, and we're skiing down the Valley of Death, the Northeast Fork. We get avalanche again, and the blocks of ice stop, you know, inches from our tent. Then we get down to the end of the valley, and I'm just following the rope. You know, we're in a whiteout, and Bob's, I think, following ski tracks from Japanese, and I'm just following the rope. If the rope moves, I follow it. And suddenly, the rope goes very, very tight. And I'm jerked off my feet, and it goes even tighter, like a mighty jerk. And I'm pulled through the snow by some huge force. Obviously, Bob has fallen. And he'd fallen over an ice wall. He just hadn't seen it from the whiteout. And the only thing that saved us is that Bob got post-holed up to his waist in deep snow. But of course, I had all the slack and went flying past him into a crevasse. And I must have bounced off the sides a couple of times. I broke my wrist and I had a big concussion. And I come to eventually upside down because my pack had inverted me, staring down into this huge blue hole. I knew I was in a crevasse. I knew I was a climber. I didn't know who I was, and I didn't know who I was with. You know, I was pretty banged up. But I knew whoever was on the other end of the rope was probably going to join me here if something didn't happen. But it did. There was a team of climbers from Philadelphia, I think, and they were the Twin Cities Health Club Expedition. Two of them had seen it. They'd been on the glacier just not far below, a guy called Paul Dvernak and Steve Friddle, and they ran up the snow slope, you know, breaking trail, taking turns to beat down the deep snow to get to Bob Kandiko to release the pressure on him, because he was beginning to get close to passing out from holding my weight. And Steve was the first person I remember seeing as he rappelled and downclimbed, I think, into the crevasse, about 40 foot to come level with me, turned me up the right way, and realised that I couldn't do anything with my right hand. It was so badly fractured. And they rigged up a pulley system and got me out. In Olympia in 2015, I was with Bob and Mike Helms at a Mountaineers slideshow award evening. And Bob was the keynote speaker. And a guy walked out of the crowd up to me and said, I'm Steve Friddle. Do you remember who I am? Oh, yeah, no, I do. I do. He said, there aren't too many Friddles in the world. He said, yeah, I was the one that pulled you out of the crevasse. He said, you smelled so bad, I nearly gagged while I was doing it. I had to turn my face away from you. You smelled so bad. Anyway, we're still not out of the woods, because now I've got concussion. I've got a smashed wrist. We're out of food again. Fortunately, the Twin Cities guys were very gracious, and they gave us some food to keep us alive for a couple of days. The weather was terrible. They were going to fly me out, but couldn't, because the helicopter couldn't get in. And then the climbing ranger, Dave Buchanan, who was at the Kahelmna base, decides that we only can't leave him there. It's just crazy. Let's get a couple of sleds together and make a big toboggan and put me in it. He got some volunteers to ski up there, a couple of Swiss mountain guides were very useful, and a posse of people that were happy to pull ropes. And that's how I got back to Gehelm Base. I was, you know, lashed into this thing and towed back, where I met Frances Randall, who was the lady who ran Gehelm. Frances was the radio operator, all the pilots there. She put me in her spare tent. No one else would go in it with me because I smelled so bad. And I got to be the first one out in the morning because I was the most injured. There were others. And Doug Geeting came and got me, and a German guy who had frostbite. And we flew out. And, you know, to me, the sound of the engine sounded like a wail of pain, which is the way I felt. Geeting's flying with the windows up again. He said, "Man, you smell worse than my horse's ass." We landed in a little strip somewhere in Anchorage. I don't know where it was. There was an ambulance waiting, and they took us to Providence Hospital, where I'm examined. And they're really concerned about head injuries because I've had a fall. And they're very interested in the cerebral edema. The broken wrist is a minor issue. And as soon as they figure out what I've done, I'm taken to be cleaned up, and they put me with all my clothes on into this pot of hot bubbling water so it wouldn't smell so bad, and the nurses just cut the clothes off and threw them away. And normally I would have been really sad to see all that expensive clothing disappear, but I'd lost interest in it completely. X-rays, you know, the grim reality of how badly my wrist has been broken was brought home to me, but you know, I figured I'd survive. They start feeding me. It's wonderful. And then when I'm all done, I'm wheeled into the burns unit, because that's where they like to treat frostbite victims. I think the burns treatment and frostbite treatment must be similar in some way. I'm wheeled into a ward headfirst, so I can't see where I'm going. And the nurse says something like, "I think you two know each other." And there's Jack on the other bed. So our last bivouac in Denali was actually in the burns unit. The fun of the two Lewis guys is gone. I mean, the atmosphere's not the same at all. It wasn't supposed to be that way. And, you know, we've taken a psychological beating. Jack's really upset about what happened and having to consider leaving me, and he can't find the words to describe it. And neither can I. British stuff up a loop. Jack was the same. It was sad. You know, we'd survived, but we're never going to be the same again. Somewhere in there, and on the trip back to Australia, I decided that, because my girlfriend had gone to Australia for the summer. She was Australian. And I called her and explained what had happened. She said, "Well, you come to Australia. It's beautiful. You obviously can't work. The weather's perfect. You know, come down here and get well." And Jack decided he wanted to stay in Alaska. So we said, "So long." And, you know, I thought I could see him soon somewhere. And I flew to Australia, and I decided that I would move there. It was just so beautiful that it became my home for decades. I still have a home. I went back to London, and it began to occur to me that I probably didn't have any climbing ambitions anymore, and I couldn't think of doing anything more epic than that and get away with it. And I began to count the number of friends that I'd already lost to climbing, and you know, it wasn't that I was afraid of it, I just thought it's not sustainable. And I was really empty and hollow for many years afterwards, until I found other things to amuse myself. Anyway, I saw Jack one last time in London. He was climbing with Jim Bridwell. They'd been in Chamonix. They'd had a good summer. And I got a phone call out of the blue. And he said, "Hey, we're in London. You know, let's have dinner." Jack actually wound up staying with me for a couple of months. He got a job at the same climbing store I was working at. And we had some fun and we got some beer. But he was trying to drag me back into the mountains, and I just wasn't having it. You know, it was a bit sad. I never saw him again. He was the strongest climber I've ever climbed, you know, by far. And so solid. You know, he's the sort of person that if you were inclined to go out on a limb, he'd be the person I'd want to go with. And he felt the same, apparently. So we had a hell of a time. Just 3 years. And, purple patch that had to come to an end. I moved to Australia and took up cave diving really seriously. So, you know, the need for adventure was still there. I just changed the direction, and there we are. Decades passed. I moved to Hong Kong for a project here, and then started a business with my now business partner, Peter. And I found out that Jack had been killed in 2012. It floored me. I thought, well, I've got to write about this. And as you know, I have. And that book has been cathartic for me and Pam Roberts. And has reunited countless people. It's been a very positive thing. I'm so glad that I did it.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, chatting with you half a world away, and I can, as we speak, I can just hear the emotion well up inside you when you think back to that time in your life and you think back to Jack. How does that feel, reliving that and talking about it?
It's tough. I often give talks, you know, I really got to watch it. I don't crack up at a particular point. I can never see it coming. But anyway, there it is. Perversely, the book has connected me with all sorts of people, and there are a whole string of events that have happened in a certain way that if they'd been different in any other way, I wouldn't have survived, or I wouldn't have written the book, or whatever. And the last one, I heard your podcast with John Waterman. And John and I have become friends, pen pals like this. We've not met physically yet, but we will. And the only reason I found out about what had happened to Jack is that a friend of mine, who I used to go hiking with a lot in Hong Kong, Alan, he was a work colleague, but we were great friends, nearly had a hiking accident. This sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But we'd taken a shortcut down a gully that got pretty steep, you know, in our 50s or approaching 60s. You know, we realized it was a mistake. And I jokingly said to him, as we tumbled out of the weeds into the highest path behind the village where I live, and I said, "Don't you ever take me down that again." He said, "Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad. After your epic on Denali, that's nothing." And I looked at him, because I've never discussed it with anybody, really. Al likes to Google people. You know, I never would have thought to do that, but he did, and he Googled me. He found John Waterman's book, Surviving Denali, in which I'm chapter 2, cerebral edema, you know. And if John hadn't have written that, Alan would have read it and would never have connected, never made that remark. And I never would have started to think about, gee, I wonder what happened to Jack, you know. And just amazingly, by accident, it was Alan that found out. He got onto a climbing blog and said, "Look, you better read this hyperlink I'm sending you because someone's looking for you." And didn't tell me what it was. And it was a rest in peace message on Super Topper, that's it. And it was a message from Dane Burns, who was one of Jack's friends, looking for me. Does anybody know what happened to Simon McCartney? He disappeared. And then 81 did a couple of routes with Jack Roberts in Alaska. Does anybody know where he is? Of course, I'd moved continents 2 or 3 times. And there was no email back then. And was no, I wasn't in the climbers. There was no community that would know where I went. Or I didn't discuss it with anybody. So, I just disappeared off the face of the earth. But if Alan hadn't have made those connections and John Waterman hadn't mentioned me, the bond might never have happened. I wouldn't have ever, it would have gone to the grave with me. So that's good. I feel very positive about that.
All right, well, thanks for hanging out with me today. I hope you got as much out of Simon's stories as I did, and I hope you can apply some of his alpine and life wisdom to your next trip in the mountains. You can find Simon's award-winning book, The Bond, online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or any place good books are sold. Don't forget to leave a review for The Fernline on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to support this podcast from the ground up, remember, you can become a monthly subscriber over on Patreon. And finally, if you enjoy the tunes you hear on this podcast, you can check out more of my music on iTunes, Spotify, Bandcamp, and evanphillips.net. All right, well, take care of yourselves, and we'll catch you next time on The Fern Line. People stay together. They find their way through the hard times. You can follow. 'Cause I ain't gonna stay.
goes going nowhere, and I ain't headed back to that place. Every day, people stay together. They find their way through the hard times. You can follow me, 'cause I ain't gonna stay here. I keep changing, right by. Right.